So it would be a shame to let a whole roast lamb go to waste. So obviously, once you slaughter the Korban Pesach, the Paschal offering, you have to eat it. Everybody, as we discussed last time, the way it works is that if you have a group that decides in advance that they all want to go in together to purchase a Korban Pesach, and then they all come to the Beis HaMikdash together, and the whole group slaughter this offering on behalf of the entire group. So then, later that night, we're going to they have to eat it, obviously. There are different levels and different types of korbanos, different types of offerings about how much gets burnt on the mizbeach, the altar. There are some offerings that are completely burnt on the mizbeach, and there are some offerings that are eaten by the people who bring it, and some that are eaten by the priests. So here, the Korban Pesach, it's all eaten by the people who bring it. Just a little bit, they sprinkle the blood on the altar. There's a little bit of that, but basically, it just gets to be part of a lovely feast. So it says the Sefer HaChinuch, we're starting Mitzvah Vav, which states, Lechol Besar HaPesach, to eat the flesh of the Paschal offering, Beleil Chamisha Asar B'Nisan, on the night of the 15th of Nisan. The offering is slaughtered on the 14th, which is the holiday called Pesach in the Torah, whereas the holiday that we call Pesach is called in the Torah Chag HaMatzos, the festival of unleavened bread. So on the first night of Chag HaMatzos, of the festival of unleavened bread, you eat the Korban Pesach, the Paschal offering, which is brought the day before on the 14th of Nisan. Al pi tenoim shebakosuv, according to the ways that are discussed in the Torah, shenemar ve'ichlu es habasar balaylo hazeh, that you eat the meat on that night. That night meaning, of course, the first night of what we call Pesach, the 15th of Nisan. So what does it mean when it says Tnoim Shebakosuv? What does the Torah say when it says how to eat the Passover offering? It says Al Matzos Umrorim Yochluhu. And certain other things. But you'll notice that while the safe that you should eat the Pesach offering with unleavened bread, matzos, and marorim, and bitter herbs. So you notice that the Sefer HaChinuch does not count a separate mitzvah of eating maror, where he does count a mitzvah of eating matzah on the first night of Pesach. So why is this? The answer is that midoraisa, on a biblical level, the only time you have to eat maror is when it's in conjunction with a Korban Pesach. You can have a nice sandwich, a nice lafa with some lettuce and some meat, and you know, it's very, very tasty. It's not like nowadays. The hard matzah, and we have no Korban Pesach, and we use chrein for maror, horseradish, which we'll discuss more about in a second. So there's actually a difference of opinion between the Rishonim. The Rambam says that it doesn't literally mean that you make a sandwich out of all three. It means that you make a sandwich out of just matzah and maror, the way we do nowadays as a remembrance to the Beis HaMikdash, and then you eat the Pesach offering separately. The way the Rambam presents it is that at the beginning of the meal, you eat, you make hamotzi al achilas matzah, you eat your sandwich of matzah and the maror, and then later in the meal, at the very end, you eat another kezayis of, another olives bulk of the Korban Pesach, and that's what you conclude your meal with. That's like, nowadays, instead of doing that, we have matzah at the end of the meal. Yeah, what we call the afikomen, even though it derives from the phrase in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, "Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikomen." One cannot eat dessert after the Pesach, after eating the Korban Pesach. So afikomen doesn't originally refer to the offering itself or the matzah itself. It means the dessert that you're not supposed to eat after the matzah. So colloquially, we call the afikomen the thing that with which we conclude the meal, that the matzah or the Pesach is our dessert. So the Rambam says that you have your sandwich of matzah and maror, and then you eat the Korban Pesach in the fashion I just described. Whereas according to other authorities, you do make a sandwich out of all three. You eat all three together. So that's also two different versions of the text of the Haggadah. One says, Zecher l'mikdash kehillel, keino sehillel b'zman shebeis mikdash haya kayom, haya korech matzah u'maror v'ochel yachad. He would wrap up matzah and maror and eat them together. And one version of the Haggadah says, "Hayakorech Pesach matzah or maror biyachad." You would wrap up the offer, the Pesach offering, and matzah and maror together, and eat them all at once. So, also obviously, since it says korech that you wrap it up, in the times of the Mishnah, they had matzah that was soft. This is, 50 years ago, no one ever heard of this. They would have been scandalized. Now we know, more exposure to other Jewish communities, we know that even to this day, there are Jewish communities where they bake matzah soft. There's no din, per se, that matzah has to be hard and cracker-like. The only reason that people bake hard cracker-like matzah is because it doesn't get moldy. You can bake it all before Pesach, like the practice that we have to bake all the matzah before Pesach, because we're afraid maybe a little bit of dough will get mixed in that's become chametz, and then if it's before Pesach, then you can apply the laws of bittul, of nullification of forbidden foods. But if it gets mixed in on Pesach, then, as we all know, then even the tiniest amount of chametz will forbid us from eating the entire mixture. So since we have that chumrah to bake everything before Pesach, then it makes sense to make hard cracker-like matzah because it lasts. As we all know, there's 5 boxes of matzah in the kitchen here, and the reason that we have that instead of rolls is because we don't need to freeze it. There's absolutely no halacha per se that matzah has to be hard. It's perfectly acceptable to make matzah soft, and nowadays that we have freezers, there is no reason. You could just make soft matzah beforehand and freeze it. I think Yemenites, I don't know about this to this day, but till recently when they were still in Yemen, they baked fresh matzah every day of Pesach. Fresh, warm, soft. I wouldn't say fluffy. It's still very dense, obviously. It doesn't rise, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a question actually about Matzias regarding the Korban Pesach itself. Now, nowadays, I guess lambs can be born any time of the year and any time of the world, part of the world, again, New Zealand or something like that.
Yeah.
But in Eretz Yisrael, lambs generally were born in the spring, I think.
Right.
So that would mean then, if it had to be less than a year old, it would be very, very young, wouldn't it?
Correct. When the Korban Pesach was offered, the lamb was very, very young, which means it's, they were very small. So you only had a little bit of it. You didn't have so much. And when we get to a little bit later in the Sefer Chinuch, I'm going to discuss more of exactly what the size was that you had to eat.
That is also a place where the word Pesach is left out. So I think it's understandable the member of Hillel, that Pesach was left out, but originally was part of the correct gear, so it was done that way. That's what I think anyway.
Oh, you think in the terms of our Haggadah, when it says Pesach Matzah Hayakorech Pesach Matzah Mor, it was just left out? That's more likely than it was added in, according to other gears. Right, but the Rambam... Yeah, okay. Yeah, it could be. Definitely. But still, the Rambam Shita is that it was eaten separately. Okay, yeah, very good point. Also, so since matzah, there are some people, of course, okay, we can't change anything, like we discussed with the mitzitza bepet. Same people who say you have to have actual mitzitza sucking on the circumcision wound with direct oral contact, the exact way they used to do it because they thought it was hygienic. So too, you'll have people nowadays who tell you that, no, our minag, our custom is to have hard matzah and we can't change it at all. So I think most honest people will admit that that's not the case. And it's perfectly fine for Ashkenazim, for Sephardim, for anyone to have soft matzah on Pesach. But the caveat, of course, that a lot of times the hard cracker matzah that we have is made to a higher standard of kashrus than a soft matzah. But if you have soft matzah, which is made to a perfectly acceptable standard of kashrus, there's no reason to refrain. Certainly, if you have difficulty, not necessarily in the Mishnah, but there are the halacha says that you're allowed to crumble the matzah into fine pieces. So if you're old and you can't digest, you can't digest regular hard matzah, certainly one should try to get good, perfectly kosher soft matzah before resorting to the crumbs. Yeah.
As far as I gather, hold that you make mazonos on matzah crackers. during the year. And then, so maybe this could be the soft matzah is more like bread. You could,
sure.
Matzah would be, you know, less of a problem for them.
There are poskim who say that since matzah is hard, then you make a mezonos on it when you have it throughout the year, not on Pesach, because it's known that we always have meals with matzah on Pesach, so it automatically acquires the status of a motzi. But it, on... mostly Sephardi poskim, but some... it makes sense. What's the difference with that and another cracker? So others, mostly Ashkenazi poskim, will argue that since matzah, whole regular-sized matzah, is a food that you normally have in the context of a meal and not as a snack, so then it acquires the status of hamotzi during the year also. However, the soft matzah certainly has the status of hamotzi throughout the year, no matter when you eat it. No, it's not tied into Pesach at all. What's
it
normal? Be a normal.
To buy the soft matzah?
What?
Is it available during the year?
During the year to buy soft matzah? No, but it's around Pesach time. They bake it in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And you can order from Israel, of course. But, yeah. So also connected to this, of course, is the fact, like I said, it used to be like a shawarma. You have your lafa, not really, matzah, it's very dense still. You could tell it's matzah. It doesn't taste light and fluffy and nice like a lafa. But it used to be you could wrap it up, like make a nice sandwich. So, of course, the other ingredient in a nice meat sandwich in a shawarma is vegetables, is some sort of lettuce or other type of herb. So since, of course, we'll go a little bit into the discussion of maror now, because, like I said, the Sefer HaChinuch does not have a separate mitzvah of maror, because midaraisa, on a biblical level, it's not required to eat maror nowadays when there's no Korban Pesach. It's only midarabanan. The Chachamim said that we have to eat maror nowadays as a remembrance for when it was in the Korban Pesach. So if you're going to tell me, okay, so how do we use horseradish nowadays sometimes for maror? So there was an excellent article that appeared in a YU publication, but it's one of the few articles that appeared in YU publications that made its way into Haredi literature in Israel, that traced very excellently by someone by the name of Schaefer, he's still alive, was in a publication called Gesher, I believe the 8th volume, where he traces the whole history about how basically in the lands of Northern Europe there was no lettuce in the spring, so because it was still freezing cold. So they started to use vegetables. They started to rely on the opinion of some poskim who state that b'di'eved, ex post facto, if you don't have any of the types of maror which are mentioned in the Mishnah as explicitly as being kosher for the mitzvah of maror, then you're permitted to use any bitter vegetable. So this was the most bitter thing they have, even though people point out that horseradish is not really bitter. It's sharp. It's a completely different taste sensation from nice bitter lettuce. So that's a problem. That's a problem. So I think... Rabbi Willig has... by his Seder, he makes the bracha l'chilas maror on lettuce, romaine lettuce, which is for sure good. It's called chasa in the literature of Chazal. Chazeres, rather, I'm sorry. It's called chazeres, and the Gemara says, what's chazeres? What does the Mishnah mean when it refers to chazeres? It means chasa, means romaine lettuce. In Arabic, lettuce is called chas. Also, we have, exactly what it is. So for with romaine lettuce, you're for sure good. So then, still, we've gotten, as East descendants, most of us of European Jews who didn't have lettuce in the Pesach time, and they used chrein, horseradish, because they didn't have anything else. So he takes, after he finishes his real maror, which is lettuce, the children want to see, they want to see Tati cry, because everyone knows that... that maror is supposed to make you cry, which is a very recent concept, because originally it was very tasty. It's a little bitter. Okay, lettuce can be a little bitter, but it's still tasty. Maror is not really supposed to make you cry. It's not supposed to make you choke. It's not supposed to make you, any of these things. But still, since we've gotten used to the idea that that's part of the Seder experience to have Tati cry and have... Right. So he eats... he eats a spoonful of chorein afterwards. So if you want to do that, if your kids insist on it, but if you train your kids, if sometimes people say, well, what do you use for maror? Do you have real maror, or do you just have that weak lettuce stuff? So if you train your kids from a young age that lettuce is the real maror, then you might not have this problem.
It doesn't feel better.
So that's an excellent question. That's a very good point. So what happens if the maror does not actually taste bitter? So according to the conventional interpretation of the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, in its discussion of the Mishnah, where it discusses the five types of species that can be used as maror, it asks the question, so how could you use lettuce, romaine lettuce, for maror? It's sweet. So according to so then it goes on to say, since it starts out sweet and then it becomes bitter later on in its development, then it's considered actually more preferred, because that's exactly how it was in Egypt. Originally, when the Egyptians enslaved the Jewish people, they were very nice to them and they made them feel welcome in Egypt. And then only later did their experience become bitter when they became enslaved. So that's why to eat something that starts out sweet and then gets bitter is considered perhaps even more preferable than something that's always bitter. The Chazon Ish has a different interpretation of this Gemara, this Yerushalmi, where he says that no, the maror actually does have to taste bitter. If not, you're not yotze. You don't fulfill the mitzvah unless it actually tastes bitter. Now, there are indications that there are Rishonim who held like this also, that the maror, that is a problem. Even if it starts out sweet, it doesn't, for the purpose of the mitzvah maror, you have to wait till it gets bitter to be yotze with it. It makes a lot of sense. If it's supposed to be remembrance of the bitter slavery, it makes a lot of sense that it actually has to be bitter. So, for that reason, there are some people who use for the mitzvah of maror endives, because endives are a lettucey type species and they are actually bitter. Now, the Mishnah says that one of the species that you're yotze with for the mitzvah of maror is called ulshin, and in modern Hebrew, endive is olesh, and Rashi translates ulshin on the Mishnah as hendiva or something like that. So probably there's a continuation of tradition that anything in the endive chicory species is included in this, and it is acceptable. But nevertheless, since there is some, even though there are opinions that hold that anything bitter works to fulfill the mitzvah, since we're not 100% sure, that endives are one of the species mentioned in the Mishnah, so. Perhaps an appropriate course of action is to rely on the common minag that we're not makbid that the maror has to be specifically bitter, and to eat some lettuce and then also have some endive. You know, well, who cares?
You if you have can. Endive, you say you have
yeah, I do have endive. But
do your parents have endive?
No, this is my this is my innovation. Although maybe this year you'll have endives. Yeah, maybe.
For sure.
So the endives are also, that's one of the advantages some people use them, is because endives are very clean and they don't really contain bugs so much. I think they're grown, the current endives that we have today are grown underground in cellars. That's why they stay white. So that's another reason people prefer endives, because it's much easier to clean from bugs because there basically are none. So, but the best thing really would be to get romaine lettuce nowadays, the way people want to buy it and sell it is they want to sell it. They want it to be sweet. They don't want it to be so bitter. But the best thing would be, I don't know, there's no demand for this, really. We should have, in Gush Katif, where they have all Jewish farms and trying to produce people for, not in Gush Katif anymore, but the brand name, they should, if there were enough demand for it, they would probably breed some romaine lettuce to restore its bitter, to make it really bitter. So bitter romaine lettuce would be the best way to fulfill the mitzvah of maror. There's a question also if iceberg lettuce is considered acceptable for the mitzvah of maror.
No.
Reb Aaron Cutler is reported to have said that it's fine. It's just actually, it's related to romaine lettuce. It's a mutant species of romaine lettuce, which has no nutrition or flavor or anything. So since it is a species, it's related, closely related to romaine lettuce, then according to some post-kim, it is acceptable. Also has fewer bugs than romaine lettuce, apparently. But the best thing is to have romaine lettuce. That's romaine lettuce is for sure, the species, one of the species that is mentioned in the Mishnah as explicitly as being kosher for the mitzvah of maror. The Mishnah brings the machlokes, whether it says that you have to bring to the table on this at the Seder charoses, which is a paste. There's no specific recipe that's dictated by Chazal and the Rishonim, but it's supposed to be reminiscent of mortar, right? Some Gaonim say to put cinnamon sticks on the top, so it looks like straw. Or, it's supposed to, the more reminiscent it is to mortar, the better. I still have to research this a little bit, but I don't understand exactly how the Ashkenazi custom developed that it's sort of a coarse mixture of apples and walnuts and wine and whatever, but it's not, I don't understand how that's exactly reminiscent to mortar. I was at my mother-in-law's house last Pesach, so I was charged with making the charoses, and I put it in the food processor. So I brought it out, like, what is this? It's not charoses. I said, what do you mean? It's supposed to look like mortar. This is a real paste. Look at it. It's the most mohudar charoses you've ever had in your life. They're like, ugh. No, it's not. Can't have this. Well, no, we did use it. But so it's supposed to have a little bit of wine in it to start out, but then when you dip the maror in it, the Gemara says that the Gemara says, tzarech l'samuche v'tzarech l'kahuye, that you're supposed to make it thick, like mortar, and then you're supposed to put in wine to make it looser because of the Jewish blood that was spilled working for the Egyptians and working for their mortar. So you pour in a lot of wine and make it look like blood. Not everybody does this, but maybe it's just a thought. Maybe it's because of blood libels. Unfortunately, we want to have as few remembrances of or things that suggest blood at the Seder as possible, but nowadays aren't. I mean, whatever. But the correct practice is that you have it very thick at the beginning of the Seder, and when you're about to dip the maror in it, you add more wine to make it looser, and then you dip the maror in it. So the reason for this, the Gemara says, is that there's a worm that lives in lettuce that isn't good for you, and the point of dipping it in the charos is because the charos is very strong, strongly flavored, so it kills the worm, so it won't harm you. Yeah, that's fascinating. So you put it, since lettuce is commonly contaminated by germs, maybe it really means that you dip it in this wine-based thing, and the alcohol will kill the germs, maybe. It's fascinating. So whether or not the Tanoim disagreed over whether the charosis was per se a mitzvah, still, you're supposed to dip the lettuce in it, or whatever maror you're using, to make sure that it's not so strong or contaminated or has a bug in it or whatever this means. But still, you're not supposed to pile it on. You're supposed to just put it in charoses and take it out. It's supposed to clearly taste the bitter taste of the maror, and that's one of the indications that some posts can point out, that the maror should actually taste bitter. So that's that.
You eat endive, do you make a face?
No, endive is delicious. It's just a little bitter. It's a little bitter taste. Mm-hmm. Bitter isn't bad, necessarily. People put endive... No. People make salads and sandwiches and whatever with endive all the time. Very tasty. Okay. So that's a discussion of maror, because, there, as I said, there's no separate mitzvah in the Sefer HaChinuch for maror, so... Any other things about maror, speak now or forever hold your peace. Well, the Mishnah, even though nowadays it's a mitzvah derabanan, the Mishnah is also discussing for a time where it's a mitzvah d'oraisa. So when it's a mitzvah d'oraisa, then you have to be very careful about what you use. And even now it's mitzvah derabanan, it's not nothing. You still have to be careful about it. So you still have to be careful about what you use. It said, actually, tidbit, that the I don't know exactly how this is possible, because in the springtime, as I said, it was very cold and there wasn't so much lettuce, but there were some occasions where the Chofetz Chaim could only get lettuce from Maror, and he wouldn't make the bracha unless he had horseradish. It's a little bit the opposite of what we've been saying now, but probably he was worried about the opinions that it had to be bitter. So he thought horseradish was bitter, and lettuce was not bitter. So he wanted to make the bracha on horseradish. But now we can't turn a blind eye to what we now know to be the real history of Maror, and we know that lettuce and lettuce-like produce is really what Maror is supposed to be. So if you have your soft matzah and your lettuce and your, I guess you can. We're not having roast meat anymore on Pesach night, but we can have a more tasty Pesach than people who force themselves to eat gigantic quantities of ground horseradish. So it continues in Sefer Achinuch. Umishor she mitzvah zo, mashekosavnu bishchitoso. This reason for eating the Korban Pesach is the same as the reason for slaughtering the Korban Pesach. They go hand in hand. Kidei lizkor hanisim hagedolim she'asa lanu hakel shotzianu me'avdus. This is just every year when we engage in the Korban Pesach and the eating of it, we'll remember, we'll have the whole Seder, and we'll tell the kids, and we'll sing Dayenu, and we'll remember all the things that God did for us when taking us out of Egypt. Dinei ha-mitzvah, the laws of this mitzvah, kama chayav kol echad le'chol mimenu l'chol ha-pachos. The minimum amount that each person is required to eat from it.
Matzah?
No, Korban Pesach. So the way the Rambam presents it is that you have a little bit at the beginning of the meal, and you have a kezias of it at the end of the meal. So as we touched on very briefly by Gid Hanosha, the amount of a kezias is literally translated as an olive's bulk. The Mishnah talks about which species of olive one uses to determine which is the size of an average olive. It's a olive that was used for oil. It was a very common olive in the Middle East. So it's an olive is a very tiny amount. It's a very, very small amount. And the Gaonim say, the earliest halachic authorities after the Talmud state in their responsa that the reason that the Torah gave the shiurim for eating things for mitzvah purposes in a kezias in the size of an olive and other fruits is because these things are always around and people know how big they are and they could, you know, estimate how much they ate and if they ate an olive size of an olive and then they know that they fulfilled the mitzvah. So I forgot to bring it, but nowadays they print these charts, these little laminated charts of, you cover a certain area of the chart with matzah, and that's how you know you ate a kezias of matzah. So according to this chart, a kezias of the Korban Pesach is the size of a ribeye steak, I don't know. Mr. Greger pointed out earlier, that during that season of right before Pesach is when the lambs are born. They're very small. So how could a whole group of people who are participating in this one Korban Pesach eat such a large shear of the Korban? There's not enough for everyone. It has to go. Everyone just gets a tiny bit at the end of their meal.
Alpines.
It's not alpines, no. it's the answer is that these gigantic kezias in this whole business comes from, we can get a hint to it by the discussion of the size of a kezias of an olive in the words of the Ashkenazi Rishonim. So nowadays we're used to olives being put in jars and sent all over the world. But that wasn't always the case. There were times when olives grew in Mediterranean countries and they weren't really exported. They didn't have as good preservation systems, so they weren't really exported to the far reaches of the world. So in the northern climates of northern France and Germany, where the Ashkenazi Rishonim lived, there were no olive trees. So they didn't know how big an olive was. The Ravia states explicitly she'ein anu bikiyim b'shir kezayis. We don't know how big kezayis is, how big an olive is. Since they didn't have them, they tried to figure out, based on calculations from the text of the Talmud, how big an olive was, because they didn't know. So the Talmud states that you could swallow one egg at a time. The Mishnah also says that when we say an egg in Torah literature, we mean the size of an average chicken egg. And that's much smaller than the eggs we mostly buy nowadays, because nowadays everyone wants larger size eggs, extra large, jumbo, whatever, large size. Nobody buys medium eggs anymore. The medium, as Rabbi Schechter points out all the time, he says the medium eggs are sold to mayonnaise companies, and they're all just they're put in processed products. Nobody really buys medium eggs. They're much smaller than the eggs we know nowadays. The average size egg is approximately 50 milliliters in volume, and the eggs we have nowadays are larger. So the Gemara states that you could swallow one egg, one whole egg, and you could swallow two olives at a time. So from this, the Ashkenazi Rishonim derived that an olive was half the size of an egg. Now, we all know what olives, even with our jumbo-sized olives and our small-sized eggs, we know there's way more than two olives in an egg, or the volume of an egg. So the question is, how do we reconcile these two things? So probably what it really means is something like that olives are harder to swallow, as you know, they have more, they're harder. An egg is goes down very easily. That's probably what the explanation is. But you'll notice that while the Ashkenazi Rishonim, who are in Northern Europe, are busy trying to figure out how big a kezias is, how big an olive is, the Sephardi Rishonim, who lived in Spain and around the Mediterranean, who had olives, they don't say boo about such a thing. There's not a single discussion in the Sephardi Rishonim about how big is an olive. They knew exactly how big an olive was. The Rambam, who people quote him as saying that an olive, that a kezias is a third of the size of an egg, they make this whole disagreement. Oh, the Rambam holds an olive is a third of an egg, and the Tosis hold that kezias is half of an egg. This is not true at all. The Rambam nowhere discusses how big a kezias is. He simply states offhand in when he's discussing a grogeres for the purpose of eating on Yom Kippur, that the shear for the eating on Yom Kippur that you're chayev for, that you receive punishment for, is the size of a dried fig, a grogeres. Oh, I'm sorry. It's not kikoseves hagasa. I take that back. Kikoseves hagasa, like a fat date. So he says that that's approximately the third the size of an egg, and then somewhere else he says that an olive is less than the size of a kikoseves hagasa, less than the size of a date. So they see from that, oh, he holds that an olive is probably just a little bit less than a third of an egg, but it's not true, because he just compares them. He says like a kezias is smaller, so of course the Rambam really held that a kezias was the size of an average size olive. And of course also there's the Ritva says in a newly published manuscript of his not newly, probably 50 years ago already, but it wasn't available for most of the Achronim to peruse. What he says that there are about six olives in an egg, and there is also, I'm sorry, he says, kama v'kama kezesim b'kebetza. There is many olives in the size of an egg. The Rashba also says there are more than six olives in the size of an egg, so it's not that they were telling you that's how big an olive is, they're just saying that that's the shear, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you know there actually are olive trees that are thousands of years old, I think some of them in Eretz Yisrael,
mm-hmm.
Which are still producing fruit. You know, which is
correct.
Yeah,
yeah.
I don't think there are any chickens who are thousands of years old who are still producing eggs. So we do have.
There are. They're not chickens, right? So we know exactly. Yeah, there's still trees that are producing fruit. We have olive pits from Masada that are the size of regular olive pits nowadays. And we actually there are chicken eggs that were found in Pompeii that were preserved in volcanic ash.
Oh.
So they're a little bit smaller than average size, not bigger. They're a little bit smaller than an average size egg nowadays. Certainly, this is an issue. So this isn't when we go back to eating the Korban Pesach. Obviously, we'll know. The Sanhedrin will tell us that the Keziah is really just the size of an olive. But in the meantime, this is more applicable for eating matzah and things like that. But we'll get to that. Let's just take your question, and we'll go back to that in a second. Yeah, because it's the minimum amount that's considered to be a significant act of eating. Correct. That's fine. The minimum shear for everything in the Torah is almost everything is Keziah. So the Shulchan Aruch writes by matzah. He's talking about matzah. He's obviously not talking about Korban Pesach. He only talks about the mitzvahs that are applicable nowadays. So he writes, Yesh Omrim, there are those who say that a kezias is half the size of an egg. He quoting Tosfos and the Ashkenazi Rishonim. So the question is, when he says Yesh Omrim, what does he mean? He means that, what does he think the main opinion is, that now he has to come tell you that, oh, there are some who disagree. There are some who write that he thought that the main halakha was in accordance with the quote-unquote Rambam, that a kezias is a third of the size of an egg, and there are some who say that, no, the main halakha follows the opinion that kezias is the size of an olive. So that's a little bit of a question. What does the Shulchan Aruch mean? But since the Shulchan Aruch does quote this opinion, even though we know that the basic halacha is really that a kezias is the size of an olive in practice, and even the Chaznish was agreed with that, by the way. We'll get more to the Chaznish later. That out of deference to the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch, one should try, for when required to eat a kezias, eat the size of half an egg. But in a case of difficulty, let's say a person is very sick on Pesach and can only force down a small amount of matzah, then, of course, one can rely on the opinion that's the main halacha, that a kezias is simply the size of an olive, which is a tiny piece of matzah. I mean, you can estimate it yourself based on your knowledge of how big an olive is, but I believe it's quoted sometimes as being about the size of a credit card. A very small piece of matzah. So even when if you assume that you have to eat a bigger shear, I mean, certainly for healthy people, out of deference to the we're not really talking about matzah now, but it technically applies to the Korban Pesach also. Out of deference to the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch, which again, probably once we have the Korban Pesach, again, will not really be accepted. We'll go back to the original halacha that it's just the size of an olive. But vis-a-vis matzah nowadays, certainly out of deference to the opinion of Shulchan Aruch, one should try to eat half the size of an egg. And since it's a quote in the Shulchan Aruch, whether it's actually his opinion or not is questionable. For most healthy people, it should not be a problem. That's not even such a gigantic shear either. But there is also a point, which is that a kezias is the minimum amount. Once you have a kezias, then you fulfilled your technical obligation. However, every amount of matzah that you eat on the night of Pesach is in fulfillment of the mitzvah. So why would, if one's healthy and can digest it, why should one be? Why should one eat only the minimum shear? Of course, one should eat more. Yeah. Well, technically, so the amount of, you have to also eat it right. Besides the fact that you have to eat a certain minimum amount, it has to be in a minimum amount of time. The minimum amount of time is called the kedei achilas pras, which is enough to eat a certain amount of pras in a normal fashion. So the shear is given as between 2 and 9 minutes are the extremes on either end. But if a pras is bigger and if you hold of a bigger shear, then the time is longer also. If you want to be machmir, it doesn't make sense to be machmir for the huge shear and to eat it in a small amount of time. Once you eat, it's ridiculous. Well, you sometimes see at the Seder, people have, he's trying to stuff down these gigantic portions of matzah in a minimal amount of time. Some people often want to be machmir to swallow it all in one fell swoop, one kezias mamish with one achila, with one act of eating. They want to eat the shear of matzah. It's ridiculous. Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said that you're not yotzei the mitzvah if you do it that way because it's not a normal method of eating. Well, I wouldn't go so far. It's totally incorrect to do such a thing. You should eat all the mitzvahs at the Seder have to be done normally. And again, I recommend, why not? Eat more matzah if you can through the course of the meal, but you certainly don't have to measure your matzah on those little handouts. I'm against those little handouts. The whole point of the shiurim of Kezayis and Kibetz are for so each person can estimate it for themselves.
You don't have to
make yourself crazy. Yeah. There is another piece of the puzzle, though, which is that nowadays that some people have even bigger shiurim. So how could that be? So what happened was that Tzlach, who was the Rav of Prague, also known as the Noda Behuda, lived in the 18th century. He measured the size of the Revius, which is the minimum measurement for the Arba Kosos, the four cups, or the cup for Kiddush, or anything that requires an official cup in Jewish law, is given in two ways in the Gemara. It's given in eggs. It's given as 2.5 eggs. Not 2.5 eggs, an egg and a half. And it's also given as two finger widths by a cube of 2 finger widths by 2 finger widths by 2 finger widths and a half and a fifth.
Which finger?
It goes by the width of the thumb. I said cube of that measurement. It's not so clear that's really a cube or whatever, a prism or whatever. We won't.
2.7.
Yeah, 2.7. Yes, exactly. That's why it was good. The seventh. Yes. So 2 by 2 by 2.7 finger width. So he measured it in eggs, in medium sized eggs, and he measured it in finger widths, and he discovered that the shear in finger widths was twice the size of the shear in eggs. So he got all nervous. He was worried that maybe what the reasoning is that eggs nowadays are half the size of what they were in the times of the Gemara. So there are two problems with this. One problem is it's just not true. There we have, like I said, we have all these eggs from Pompeii and certainly other indications from ancient literature about how big eggs were. They're not larger than they were nowadays. And also, according to the Tshuvas HaGaonim, that says that the whole point that Chazal gave this shiurim is so everyone can estimate for himself or herself, is that it goes by definition according to the eggs and olives that are found in your time. So those are the two issues. But still, he was nervous, and many people accepted this suggestion that we should really double all the shiurim. Because maybe eggs nowadays are really half the size of what they were in the times of the Mishnah and Talmud. Also, by the way, the Rambam translates the shiurim into of a revius into the weights that were known in his times, and we have weights like that from the times of the Rambam, and it comes out to exactly an egg and a half. Of our contemporary medium-sized eggs, which comes out to a revius of less, of about 2.6 ounces, or 70-75, approximately, milliliters. So a very, very small shear for a revius. So this is part of the... So according to this, if you go take the most machmir approach, then you hold that a kezias is half the size of an egg, like Tosva said. And then you have to double that because maybe eggs are now half the size. So now your kezias has to be the size of a contemporary egg. Whew. So according to that, you have to double everything. You have to double a revius also, that a kiddush cup has to be instead of 75, has to be 150 milliliters. It has to be about 5 ounces instead of 2.6 ounces.
5.5.
One of the biggest proponents of this opinion was the Chazon Ish, who actually held that the main halakha followed the Tshuvas HaGaonim, that it goes according to the eggs and olives of your time. But he said, since the shear, especially of the revius, is given in the Gemara also in finger widths, which nowadays are a little wider. It could be that our fingers nowadays are wider. It could be measured differently. There are many different suggestions to how to solve the difficulty of why the shear comes out double if you measure in contemporary finger widths than in contemporary eggs. But in any case, we know that originally that the main halacha is in accordance with the size of the eggs. But in any case, the Chazon Ish held that even if it's wrong that eggs are not twice the size, he held that since a lot of achronim, all the rabbis accepted this, not all of them, but big rabbis, the Noda Bihuda and the Gra to a certain extent and others, accepted the doubling of the measurements. Accepted the doubling of the measurements, that we should be stringent to double the measurements. So he says, even if it's wrong, you should do it anyway. Other poskim don't hold like that. They say that you can go according to the original measurement. So the Mishneh Berurah presents a compromise opinion where he says, for mitzvahs d'oraisa, for biblical commandments, one should be machmer according to the doubled measurements, but for mitzvahs d'rabbanan, for rabbinical commandments, one could be lenient according to the smaller measurement. So therefore, some people, for Kiddush Friday night, well, may not actually be d'oraisa. The cup of wine per se might not be d'oraisa, but still, since the idea of making Kiddush comes from a d'oraisa concept, and there are some opinions that Kiddush on wine is d'oraisa, that one should be machmir for the 5-ounce shear, 150 milliliters, but for, say, Havdalah, which Havdalah on wine is for sure only d'rabbanan, then one can be makel for a smaller shear. That's why some people have a bigger cup for Kiddush Friday night than they do for Havdalah. So, okay, again, like, why not? If you're, like, drinking wine, you're a healthy person, okay, use the bigger shear. But certainly the main opinion is, like, the smaller shear, so when necessary, one can be makel, according to other poskim besides the Chazon Ish, according to even in the mitzvah d'oraisa, when necessary, one can be make a like the smaller shear. So that's again, there are a lot of other. There's a whole long discussion. We could have a series of several shiurim just on shiurim, but that's the basic shiurim on shiurim. Huh? But just on the measurements of the Torah. But that's just the basic discussion for now, as basic principles as is relevant to Pesach per se. And I'm sure as Pesach gets closer, we start discussing the laws of Pesach either in the Friday night shiur or Friday or Shabbos afternoon shiur, or maybe we'll have a special shiur. We'll apply it more in practice. But there are also different opinions about how, for all these things, for how their people have an even bigger revias. Their people, I mean, anyway. But for further discussion, we'll have to do it another time. Okay, let's continue in the Sefer Chinuch. And those who participate in this Korban Pesach, how should they act until they eat it? I don't have your addition. Shelo lotzeis min achabura, that they can't leave the group. The shelo yishnu, and they shouldn't fall asleep. The yeser prote, and the rest of the issues of eating Korban Pesach, which, again, unfortunately, not relevant nowadays. Mevo'arim b'psachim are explained in Maseches Psachim, obviously, and yeah. B'noheges b'zchar m'v'nikevos, both men and women are obligated to perform the Korban Pesach. There's no difference. It's even though it's a mitzvah seseh shazman grama, even though it's a time-bound positive commandment, women are still obligated to do it because they were part of, whatever, various reasons, but because they were also part of the miracle of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and that's that. The ha'over aleha bitel asei. If you violate this, you have gone against and fulfilled to perform a positive commandment. Uchlal gadol b'chol ha'Torah. There's a great principle in the Torah in general. L'kol she'omer she'evatel mitzvah asei. If you say, ha-ha, you know, I have this thing that I'm supposed to do, and I'm not going to do it. Another example of this famously is kibud aveim, honoring one's parents, that if somebody says, I'm not going to honor my parents, then they're subject to this punishment that we're about to say. Shekofen oso bezdin im yish koach beyodom ad shekaimenu. The bezdin basically uses all methods at their disposal to force him to do it. So we beat him until Says, I'm not, parents say, oh, I want a cup of water. The kid says, I don't feel like it. Beis Din, you know, the Beis Din comes and beats him until he agrees to do it. Similarly, if you say, haha, I'm not going to do Korban Pesach, the Beis Din can beat you until you agree to do it. What? Oh, well, if you're not Pesach to say, so Binyamin asks, what about Pesach Sheni? You have a second chance. Well, the answer is that unless you're Tomei at the time of Pesach Rishon, you cannot do Pesach Sheni. You can't just say, I don't feel like
it. Everyone is Tomei, you can eat the Korban Pesach.
You can only eat the Korban Pesach when you're Tomei if most of Klal Yisrael is Tomei. Yeah, but, otherwise you have to be Tahor. So the Sefer HaChinuch says over here, Im yesh koach biyadam, that if the Beis Din has the power, because nowadays if the Beis Din beats someone up, if they declared their intention not to fulfill a mitzvah, they would be put in jail. But when the Jewish jurisprudence and autonomy returns to its original fashion, then this will be practiced. But you see what practice...
I wanted to point out a Haggadah point based on this concept of Nimnu. If you look at the Olach Mo'anya, right, in the concept of the Nimnu, it is called Ditzich Yesei V'Yisach. You make this announcement at the beginning of the Haggadah. And if you say that this the Olach Mo'anya is ancient, was the time that we had called on Pesach the Kinti, because you have to be appointed for the Korban Pesach. So obviously, either, you know, the understanding of the Halach Mo'an is different, or was added in when the Beis HaMikdash was no longer a Kayam.
Yeah, very good point. Yeah, you can't... So if you can't eat the Korban Pesach unless you, in advance, you designated yourself as part of a group, so how could we say at the beginning of the Haggadah in Halach Ma'anya, Kol Ditzrich Yesei V'Yifsach, anybody who needs should come partake in the Pesach offering. So probably either, though there have been some discussion of this in the commentaries, but it could be that this line is just added later, and it just means colloquially. It doesn't mean that you partake of the Korban Pesach. It just means colloquially you participate in the Pesach service. Anybody who needs to participate in the Pesach service can come join us. Okay? Shkach.